this nominee has probably had more experience dealing with Alaska since Alaska Governor Hickel served in this position 40 years ago.
Congress assesses President Obama's pick for Interior Secretary. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, surviving the Iditarod without your trusted leaders.
When you don't have your main dogs, especially ones that have run on the coast can be challenging for them because it's a totally whiteout possible.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
President Barack Obama's nominee to lead the Interior Department, REI Chief Executive Sally Jewell, had her time before the Senate Energy Committee today. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the hearing touched on a whole host of Alaska issues without many details.
The highlight of the day's hearing came from Tennessee Republican Lamar Alexander. Known for his wit and willingness to cut deals with both parties, Alexander wanted to know one key question.
I see that you have worked on the Alaska pipeline, that you're an oil and gas engineer. You said you'd actually fracked a gas well?
I have.
You were a banker for 19 years?
Yes, sir.
You're chief executive officer of a billion-dollar company?
Yes, sir.
How'd you get appointed by this administration?
Ms. Jewell spent the morning and part of the afternoon defending the administration's positions on climate change, public lands, and fossil fuels. In her opening statement, Senator Lisa Murkowski, the top Republican on the committee, made clear the spat over a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge would not be an issue at the hearing. She says outgoing Secretary Ken Salazar needs to address the issue before leaving office. Instead, Senator Murkowski sought to pin down Ms. Jewell on the often dueling roles of the department.
We need you to affirm that public lands provide not just a playground for recreational enthusiasts, as important as that is, but also paychecks for countless energy producers, miners, loggers, ranchers.
Senator Murkowski says she worries about Ms. Jewell's environmental leanings. She serves on the board of the National Parks Conservation Association. That she'll put conservation in front of energy production. Ms. Jewell came prepared.
Many people, as they enjoy the outdoors, jump in a car to get there. It requires fuel. Many of the products that our industry produces are produced in some way or another with materials that derive from fossil fuels.
Most on the committee wanted commitments on parochial issues in their state, some with wider appeal. Would she commit to pursuing more oil and gas development on public lands?
We're blessed with many resources on federal lands, and certainly leaning into domestic oil and gas production is an important part of the mission of particularly the Bureau of Land Management, but also the Department of the Interior.
Does she believe in climate change?
There is no question in my mind that it is real, and the scientific evidence is there to back that up.
On other issues like revenue sharing for offshore oil drilling, she avoided an answer, like a seasoned politician.
I certainly have heard from a number of senators about this issue, and if I'm confirmed in this role, I'd look forward to better understanding the issues by different states and hopefully bringing it to an appropriate resolution.
Ms. Jewell seemed to satisfy most Democrats in the panel and even some Republicans. Hanging over the hearing was Senator Murkowski's threat to filibuster the nomination. So there were overtures from Ms. Jewell to Senator Murkowski, saying they both worked on taps in some form, that she had spent years as the primary banker for the Nana Corporation, that she supports Arctic drilling so long as it's done safely. And Ms. Jewell had help from her home state senator, Democrat Maria Cantwell.
This nominee has probably had more experience dealing with Alaska in a variety of ways than anybody we've seen since Alaska Governor Hickel served in this position 40 years ago.
Before moving on to the full Senate, the committee needs to vote on the nominee. No vote has been scheduled. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
State agencies no longer need a Department of Environmental Conservation permit to use herbicides and pesticides on state property and rights of way. That's unless it's sprayed from an aircraft or directly into water. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Until now, the Alaska Railroad, the Department of Transportation, and other state agencies had to get a DEC permit if they planned to treat their property, like roads or other rights of way, with herbicides or pesticides. The permit process meant they had to provide a detailed plan that went out for public review, comment, sometimes public hearings as well. Other state and federal agencies could also weigh in before the DEC decided whether to issue a permit, and that decision could be appealed. Permits are still required for spraying directly on water or by aircraft. The DEC says that's because the increased risk of harm to public health and the environment warrants closer review. However, the agency has eliminated that public and government review process for land-based pesticide use. Pamela Miller, director of the group Alaska Community Action on Toxics, calls that decision a serious breach of the public's trust.
Many of our roadways and certainly the rail belt are located in close proximity to drinking water sources, places where people fish, gather greens and berries, and to simply remove public notification and the right of the public to participate in decisions about these herbicides and pesticides is, I think, a very serious assault on our democracy.
Miller points out that if the DOT, for example, decided to spray herbicides on land along the roadways in Southeast, they could do so without public review and comment, regardless of potential runoff into drinking water sources, salmon streams, or other particularly sensitive areas. That's not just a hypothetical situation. In a letter supporting the proposed regulation changes last summer, DOT Special Programs Manager Dan Breeden wrote that the agency had a direct interest because they intended to, quote, apply herbicides in our rights of way, airports, and at some facilities, unquote. While the agencies will no longer need a permit to use herbicides, the DEC says they will still have to publish public notices in a newspaper 30 days before the chemicals are applied. Bob Blankenberg is the DEC's Solid Waste and Pesticides Program Manager.
They do have to do public notice that they're doing this so people are aware of what their plans are and, can, choose to avoid the area, or what have you. They also have to notify DEC, so we have the opportunity to inspect the application if we decide we need to.
Blankenberg says the permitting process was a problem for state agencies dealing with what he calls time-sensitive pest management issues.
Such as invasive weeds along right-of-ways, and in a lot of cases, the inability to treat those promptly results in the weeds spreading and creating a greater problem.
In its written response to public comments on the issue, the DEC emphasized the federal government had extensive review, registration, and labeling requirements for pesticides and maintained that the Environmental Protection Agency's analysis of each product was, quote, sufficient to protect human health and the environment from unreasonable adverse effects, unquote. So instead of a permit, the new state regulations call for an integrated pest management plan that must be followed before pesticide and herbicide applications can occur on state-owned lands. According to Blankenberg, that requires agencies evaluate the extent of the problem and how it should be addressed. Anchorage Representative Les Guerra was among those who submitted comments opposing the changes. He calls the integrated pest management plan requirement meaningful.
You can still spray pesticides along a fishing stream, and according to DEC, that's okay without any public comments at all. You can still spray in an area where DEC just might know. It might be a vein that leads to somebody's water well. DEC won't know.
Guerra says his office is considering legislation on the issue. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The Alaska Railroad is cutting more than 50 jobs in an effort to trim the corporation's costs as federal grants and revenue decline sharply. About half of the jobs are already vacant. Christopher Odneson is president of the Alaska Railroad. He says the cuts will come from all areas of the company, but more than one-third of the jobs lost are in management.
Maybe the best way to explain it is to give you an example. My direct reports have gone from 13 to 6. And we've taken out lots of management positions, many of them senior positions.
Odneson says one of the company's main revenue sources comes from shipping coal, but the railroad is operating just 2 coal trains per week, down from 4 last year, because the international coal market has weakened. Grant funding from the Federal Transit Administration has also declined sharply. Combine that with an unfunded federal mandate to implement a new safety system, and Odneson says it adds up to a $45 million hit to the corporation. Besides the job cuts, Odneson says the railroad is trimming millions of dollars by conserving fuel, changing the way it maintains vehicles, and reforming other out-of-date practices.
So we have changed the company so it looks very different from the inside, but shouldn't look different from the outside to passengers, freight shippers, the public, hoping that as we go forward, we will be nimble enough and lowered the cost base enough in this company where we can weather any additional storms that might come along. While we hope for and look for revenue increases to come back to get us out of this challenge.
Since 2009, the railroad has cut nearly 300 positions out of a workforce of about 900 employees. A jury today ruled in favor of the city of Homer and 3 Homer police officers who were accused of acting recklessly during a 2006 shootout at the Homer airport. The 8-member jury decided not to award any money to the plaintiff, Sherry Dietzman, who sought $23 million in compensation for severe injuries caused to her son, Jason Anderson Jr. The case stems from a chaotic scene that unfolded at the airport when U.S. Marshals working with Homer police and Alaska State troopers attempted to apprehend 31-year-old Jason Anderson Sr., a wanted drug felon from Minnesota who had fled to Homer. The marshals lured Anderson to the airport, and when police cornered him, he pulled a handgun and 3 Homer police officers returned fire. Anderson Sr. was killed during the resulting shootout, and his then 2-year-old son, Jason Anderson Jr., was shot in the head. The boy lost sight in one eye and suffered brain damage that has required 24-hour medical care ever since. In 2011, Dietzman settled a separate lawsuit against the U.S. Marshals for $3.5 million. Homer City Attorney Thomas Klinkner says the city tried to reach a settlement with Dietzman, but to no avail. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, from the stuffy walls of the state capitol to the stage with a band called Spank the Dog.
I'm just Dan here. I'm just the bass player. I'm not representing Sadler, and I like it that way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2013 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 16th through the 23rd. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage.
Martin Boozer's unusual strategy in this year's Iditarod is paying off, at least for now. The Big Lake musher took his 24-hour layover early in the race. That put him behind for several days, but he regained the lead at about 2 p.m. this afternoon when he left the checkpoint of Iditarod. He will have a several-hour lead on his closest competitors, including Lance Mackey, Aaron Burmeister, and Ali Zirkel. As Iditarod teams spread out on the trail, lead dogs will start to prove themselves. It's up to the mushers to make sure their leaders remain healthy at the front of the team. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, that's no small feat.
The wind picked up along the Takotna River as Aaron Peck blew through the checkpoint. Peck is coming off a 24-hour rest in McGrath. He's pleased with his lead dogs.
Dakar and Sabretooth. They're both 3 years old, so they're just right in their prime. They're just loving the trip.
Hey, fellas. Hey.
But dogs are tricky. Brent Sass had to drop 2 of his main leaders back in Rainy Pass. Now he's thinking of other ways to run his team.
When you don't have your main dogs, especially ones that have run on the coast can be challenging for them because it's totally white out possible. So try everybody up there. Switch them around a lot and see who does best in what conditions.
Dropping a leader might be in the cards for Mike Williams Jr. of Akiak.
You know, I don't want to drop him. If I carry him now and try him out after that rest, and he'll have well over 30 hours of rest and and then maybe you can bounce back and make it to Nome.
The young veteran says he's not ready to make any major decisions, but major decisions were made for Ramey Smith. He says a vet forced him to leave a very experienced lead dog back in Squintna.
His name was Barley. He was a perfect dog, immaculate health. He should be here helping the team. He's a leader. I'm sure he misses the fact he's not here. I miss him.
It was a move Smith didn't agree with. He was still stewing over the incident as he furiously bootied up his dogs in Takotna. He says he's trying not to let it get to him.
Yep, get you off on the wrong foot. Now I'm doing great. You know, my dogs are doing great. And I've got a very positive attitude that I want official action against those vets.
Smith requested an official apology from race veterinarians. He's also requesting official action from the race marshal. On the Iditarod Trail in Takotna, I'm Emily Schwing.
A Dillingham couple attempted to set a new world record yesterday. They believe they have built the most airtight house on the planet. KDLG's Dave Benninger stopped by as they prepared to test that theory.
The only thing you're allowed to seal is the HRV vents, the heat recovery vents, because that's obviously big holes into the house that would make the house very leaky.
The Marsig place at the end of Gauthier Way sits overlooking an expanse of open tundra. It's a simple home, quaint and cozy, with very modern amenities. Think Jeremiah Johnson meets the Jetsons or something like that. Tom and Kristen started building the home in 2010 with super energy efficiency in mind. And to achieve that, they need an extremely tight air seal.
It was developed specifically for this purpose, for super insulated and super tight buildings. And today we are testing how tight actually this house is.
Another major component of their energy-efficient design is insulation. The walls are 28 inches thick, stuffed full of high-tech insulation that covers every inch of the place that's not a door or window, of which there are few. The house doesn't use much energy, but what it does use comes from electricity.
It has no oil tank, no propane tank, no wood pile. This is a 100% electric house.
If there was a source of renewable energy available here, Marsik says his house would be net zero energy. As it is, he considers it net zero energy ready. The purpose, of course, is to live economically in cold places where heating oil goes for about $6 a gallon. And so far, so good. In 2012, the Marsiks used about 3,700 kilowatt hours of electricity total. Even better, he calculates an annual heating bill to be the equivalent of about 35 gallons of heating oil in an area where many homes burn through two or three times that a month, especially in the winter. Marsik teaches in the Sustainable Energy Program at UAF's Bristol Bay campus, and his home has become a teaching tool and a model. He believes the house is practical, affordable, and replicable anywhere. Which brings us back to Wednesday's test. A world record could be a great way to advertise his techniques. Running the test is local heating and cooling expert Gordon Isaacs, who's a certified blower door operator.
What we're doing is depressurizing the building, blowing air out of the building through that teeny little hole. And all the air that's going out through that little hole is coming in through air leaks throughout the house. Any staple holes or anything may have a teeny little air leak, and tiny air leaks all add up to something. In this case, not very much.
Air tightness is measured in air changes per hour, and before the test, Marsik predicts a rating of 0.06, which he doesn't believe has been achieved elsewhere. As Isaacs runs the test, it becomes clear the house may beat those expectations.
It's calculating 0.05 air changes per hour. That's very, very small. Very little leakage in this house. It's by far the tightest house that I've ever tested, and I've tested quite a few.
Predictably, Marsik is pleased by Wednesday's results.
Based on the results that I have seen that are available to public, this is the tightest house that I am aware of in the world, yes.
Dillingham's Mayor Alice Ruby was on hand to witness the test. The results will be sent to the World Record Academy, which is not quite as illustrious as Guinness. The latter prefers the more weird and wonderful and didn't bite at a new airtight homes category. Marsik says that's okay. The recognition doesn't matter as much as advancing the progress in this important field. He's expecting to know within a month whether or not his home holds the world record. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The house where the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the hill where the University of Alaska Fairbanks sits, is again being recognized by its Athabascan name. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, a native elder is calling it an important first step toward restoring many Athabascan place names around Fairbanks.
You may know it as College Hill and the far end of it as the West Ridge, but 85-year-old Robert Charlie will be glad to help you get to know the official name for the bit of elevated terrain on which the UAF campus stands. Charlie says the recent decision by the U.S. Board of Geographic Names to formally designate the hill as Troth Yedda was historic because recognizing the name that the lower Tanana Athabascan people have long used for the hill affirms this place as their homeland.
We were the people that were here first. And so I'm trying to open people's eyes about you're on Indian land. That when you're walking on the university hill here, you're stepping on our ancestors' footprints.
The soft-spoken, self-taught consultant to the UAF's Alaska Native Language Center has been working for years with the help of his father, Moses Charlie, and other elders to catalog some 4,000 Athabascan place names throughout the Minto area where he was born and grew up. Charlie worked with a handful of UAF faculty and staff to gain support from university leadership for the indigenous place name and creation of a park of the same name on campus. He says the Federal Place Names Board's recognition of Troth Yedda is an important victory in Alaska Natives' ongoing struggle to preserve their culture, in this case not only through the place name and the wild tuber that indigenous people have long harvested in this area, but also the subsistence lifestyle that is central to their culture.
Troth is sweet potato. And our people used to stop by here and they would pick troth while they're here. Salta people, Chena people, Nenana people, Minto people would all come here for that purpose.
Gary Holton, a native language expert and director of the Alaska Native Language Archive, who works with Charlie, says the formal recognition of Troth Yedda is a breakthrough that may pave the way for recognition of many other indigenous place names around Fairbanks and elsewhere in Alaska.
There's a lot of interest. We've already, over the last couple of years, been working with the U.S. Board of Geographic Names, and there is interest in being able to put these names to the next release of topographic maps. Mm-hmm. So this is where things are headed, to recognize those names which have been around on the land for centuries.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Around this time of year, Juneau is known for the bustle of the legislative session, floor speeches, and committee hearings. But after hours, some members of the Capitol gang can be found making noise of a different kind. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has the story.
Spank the Dog has one last night before their big show, and the guitarists are working out twangy covers of Beatles songs. They're crammed in a slightly dingy downtown office, furnished with an old couch and a TV playing the public affairs station on mute. It's no garage, but it'll do. Spank the Dog is a pickup band, and it's been a while since this specific group of guys played together. Because they have an ever-changing roster, it's worth running through the current lineup.
John Bitney, guitar.
Paul Foose, vocals and guitar.
Dan Sadler, bass, and sometimes I sing.
Tanika Hansen, vocals.
And their day jobs.
We're professional politicians. No, I'm a lobbyist.
I'm an amateur politician.
I'm a legislative aide.
Not at rehearsal, Senator Pete Kelly on drums, and University of Alaska President Pat Gamble, another guitarist. Spank the Dog has been a consistently intermittent feature of Juneau's music scene for more than a dozen years. As the legislature changes, so does the band. Bitney is one of the anchor members, and he says that Spank the Dog has sort of an open-door policy toward anyone affiliated with the legislature.
This is our mental health program for session.
He can't count the number of people who have played with them over the years. When it comes to drummers, it's basically a revolving door.
We found the movie Spinal Tap is true. They come, they go, they die, they go to jail, whatever the case may be. We've probably been through about 30 different iterations, I'd say.
But for all of the legislators and lobbyists and staffers who have played with the band, Spank the Dog is decidedly unpolitical. They mostly stick to covering classic rock, and when they play, their turnout is bipartisan. Pete Kelly, a Republican, says he even earned a fan in Ethan Berkowitz, who led the House Democrats for years.
He walks in, and this is, again, right after I had left the legislature, I was working for the university. So Ethan and I had been working as opposing legislators for quite a while. He walks in, and we're playing, you know, Pink Floyd or something like that. And he says, "Oh my gosh, I'm so conflicted. Pete Kelly's up there playing our music."
The night of Spank the Dog's recent performance, the Hangar Ballroom is packed. The show is a benefit for a Wounded Warriors program at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and it seems like half the people who work in the Capitol building are there. For Pat Gamble, university president, guitarist, and retired Air Force general, this is somewhat intimidating.
First time playing with a band in over 40 years, so I'm a little nervous.
He's got a receptive audience, though. At least a few people made an effort to change out of their work clothes, and even Senate President Charlie Huggins is ready to let loose.
I'm ready to rock. Let's see your version.
By the time they're a couple of songs in, the band looks just as relaxed as their Hawaiian shirts would suggest. People start dancing, and everyone seems to be having a good time. When the band takes a break for the fundraising part of the night, most people stick around. They raise $25,000. It's almost enough to make you forget that you're in the thick of Alaska's political frenzy. Even bassist Dan Sadler feels that way.
I'm just Dan here. I'm just the bass player. I'm not representing Sadler, and I like it that way.
In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.